enjoyed working with a lot is with in Korea, in South Korea. And they're one of the few countries in the world that have identified... Oh, no. Too loud?
We're good.
Okay, thank you. South Korea is one of the few countries in the world that's identified hot spots where the men also lived. Many men also lived to 100. That's unusual. Usually it's all about the women, but there's some areas in South Korea where the men live longer. So all these things have been unfolding over the last few decades, and it's been a very interesting area to work in. What this graph shows is what's happening in Japan. So the latest statistics from Japan is that they have over 60,000 people who are 100 years and older. They're adding about 3,000 a year. So really incredible growth in the number. And what this shows is in aging, we often look at these pyramid shapes to look at the structure of a population. So this is back in 1960, and these are the young people. I think that's under 20. That's a lot of middle-aged, and then the 65 and older. And the wider the width of the pyramid, the more people in that age group. And that's why we used to talk about population pyramids, because every country had some sort of shape of pyramid, and what was different about them was how wide was the bottom. This is what Japan looks like today. And when you see a pyramid like this, what you see in this so much more, many older people relative to the number of working people. And that's something we're talking about around the world, is will there be enough middle-aged working people to support older people? And this is what's projected in 2060 for Japan. And that's why you'll see many countries thinking about, well, how can we support families and families with children so we can keep our population maybe looking a little more like this. And that's why you'll see some countries, not all, interested in how can they get immigrants to come to their country. Because your immigrants are typically younger and have children so that they can provide a more stable population in terms of getting a working population to a retired and older population. So when you hear all that, you know, there's always a lot going on in the world. When you hear these things, you kind of think about what that means for a country.
Why do they expect that the older population in Japan, that graph becomes straight along the sides rather than a pyramid?
So the question is, why has Japan completely changed their shape? I was fortunate enough to be in Japan last year, and people there, the young people, just are not interested in having children. Just, like, not at all. That's a problem for at the society level. The other thing, from what you know about Japan, does Japan welcome people from other countries to settle in Japan? No. And so they have very little in-migration. And so that's something that they're dealing with. So countries in Europe especially, I'm most familiar with Germany and France, have put in policies, every kind of policy they can think of to get young people to have more children. So yeah, it's just very interesting. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The middle just gives the ages. Right here, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, this. I think that's 20. I'm not sure what that age is, and that's 65. So it just gives a little. And then the men are on this side and the women on that side.
What's the top age?
The top is 65 and older. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can see these things are unfolding very quickly. When I speak to friends in South Korea, they also said that their change in the structure of their population happened really quickly. And you can imagine that after the war, people doubled down, work. It became a wealthier company, not an interest in having children anymore. And bam, they found themselves in an aging society. So it's interesting how these things unfold in different countries. Well, this is a Japanese woman who holds 25 world records in swimming. Isn't that something? And she recently was in the news because she completed a, it was just a completion. You know, we talk about kids, oh, do we need to keep giving a trophy for just completing something? But she did complete a 1,500-meter swim and was the only person swimming that over 100 and set the world record. And she started swimming at 80. She had a knee problem, and the rehab folks said, well, I think swimming would really help that. I guess she got in the pool and apparently never got out. Okay. And she said she's going to keep swimming as long as she can. Well, not to be outdone, we have a centenarian from California, Mr. Pellman, and he holds, he broke 5 age group world masters records recently, just in September. And he does the shot put, the pole vault, that just astounded me. And he runs, and he discus, and he jumps. So I don't know if it was the long jump or the high jump. So people can do really remarkable things at 100. So if you like to Google things, you'll see all kinds of things that 100-year-old people are doing. And here's a group of a more typical what we see for centenarians, a variety in their functional abilities. It's not uncommon that people need wheelchairs or walkers, but you also see lots of people standing up in the back of the picture that are fully mobile. And this is a picture of people who were at a centenarian luncheon in Northampton County Area Agency on Aging in the Bethlehem area. I'm not really sure exactly where I am. I know I'm near Pittsburgh, but you know exactly where, east of here? Bethlehem's east of here? Okay. Well, in the United States, in our 2010 census, we have over 50,000 centenarians, and the ratio of men to women, one man for every 5 women, and most men live with others in a household, but most women live in a nursing home. That's the biggest category for them. And North Dakota is the only state with more than 3 centenarians per 10,000 people. How do you figure North Dakota got that?
They're frozen chosen.
Frozen chosen. Must be a bunch of Presbyterians up there, huh? Okay. How about migration? Is that a place where people go? No, not in 2010. That was before all the... Is it oil or shale gas? I'm not sure which thing they have up there. Might be a little bit different now. Okay, so probably a lot of the younger people left, and a lot of older people left behind. Well, if you were going to study centenarians, what would you want to know? That's what we sat down many years ago to try to figure out. What did we want to know? About diet? Okay, that's what I wanted to know, something about diet. Where do you find them? Most people do a centenarian study kind of in their, you know, wherever they live. That's why you see them in all kinds of interesting places. We thought about how we should recruit them. Our first study, we wanted to recruit the most highly functioning people. You know, the best mental health, the best intellect, the best physical health. And then we ended up with a really rosy picture of what it's like to be 100. And then we realized, well, that's not the whole picture. So it did show about the joy you could have at aging, but it wasn't the whole picture. We thought about, well, how would we recruit from a nursing home? That's very hard in this day and age, because rightly so, you know, people are protected in their environment. But a lot goes into thinking about recruitment. Okay, so if you hear about research, or maybe you're a researcher yourself, you always want a control group. How do you get a control group for 100-year-old people? Let's say you wanted to figure out if there's something special in their diet. So they're 100, they're good functioning. How do we know if there's something special in their diet? Well, we'd want to compare them to some other group. But who do you compare them to? So we struggled with what's the right control group. Yeah, so one of the things that we've done is look at other countries. And then what we discovered there, in Georgia, the centenarians eat greens and sweet potatoes. Okay, the southern pattern. I'm originally from Iowa, so I was like, greens and sweet potatoes, why are they eating that? And they said, yeah, so maybe in Iowa they eat corn. Well, then I told the Swedes, well, I think there's something about greens and sweet potatoes, you know, it might be special for longevity. And the Swedes said, Swedish centenarians do not eat greens. So then I realized, well, if you're in France, you're centenarian, you're probably drinking red wine and eating cheese. You're eating the diet that's native, and you're probably representing that diet better. You know, we all talk about kind of what we ate when we grew up. Often, some of that stays with us. So, yeah, control group was really hard. And then we also found in Georgia that people ate more. The centenarians ate more. Let's see, the greens, the sweet potatoes, whole milk, butter, sausage, compared to people in their 80s and their 60s. Okay, so then I'm like, oh, I got some splaining to do here because that's some of that stuff's not what we've been recommending. Then I got to thinking, well, okay, that's the southern dietary pattern. So most of the people who ate that way for their life passed away. So I don't. It's very hard to find the control group on that. But one of the things that we've done is look at other countries and then look at younger people in their 80s and 60s as a control group.
How about occupation?
Oh, occupation is also huge, yeah. We found in 100-year-old people there in Georgia, higher education is overrepresented. So if you look at the birth cohort, say look at people born in 1900 and then look at them in 2000, those 100-year-olds have a much higher education, you know, than that birth cohort. Yeah, so that's important too. It's kind of tricky to do a longitudinal study in 100-year-old people. We have done that. It's when your 100 life expectancy is just, you know, between 1 and 3 years, depending, you know, on the person's health and all that. So, not too much time.
Wouldn't insurance companies be a resource? You know, they do these studies about how long.
Yes. So a lot of the there's a lot of very interesting data that are available from insurance companies. We had a really interesting person, a demographer. Any demographers in here, or you have a friend who's a demographer? If you go to a cocktail party, the one talking the most is probably going to be the demographer because they have just, they're just a walking encyclopedia of all kinds of information. But yeah, he helped us quite a bit in going back through various records. And the other thing, when we go worldwide, countries really vary on how accessible their information is. So in Georgia, it was harder, probably not as hard as in every state. It's just harder to get into any kind of records. And so, like I mentioned, the Swedes and us started a centenarian study at the same time. So, you know, we called them up. Oh, we're really having a hard time recruiting. What are you doing in Sweden? He said, we just looked them up in the census and sent them all a letter, and they're all in the study. So they had a very different, you know, level of, well, I guess if you're in Sweden, everybody's in your business, so your records are there. And as time goes on, there's a little more controls over that kind of information. There's so many questions we could ask. We've always had trouble, you know, not trying to overwhelm the person. And so in one of our last studies, we had about 4 2-hour sessions to try to get through all the questions on that. People are always very interested in dementia, so I'll share a little bit of information on that. And many of the centenarian studies have been started by either psychologists or medical people. So there's quite a bit of information around the world in that area. Well, let me tell you a little about the 3 studies that we did. I'm going to spend most of the time on the 3rd study. But the first study, this was the one we started back in 1988. And this is where we had 100-year-olds, and then we had 60- and 80-year-old controls. And we learned a lot about how to do this kind of work then. Then we did a short longitudinal study, and then we learned some more. And then by the time we got to the 3rd study, I finally convinced the psychologists, who were the leaders of the study, that that, you know, we really need to draw blood samples. We need to do genetics. And we finally got that in there. And also part of the team was several specialists in dementia and dementia pathology and all of these kinds of things. So it really made for a very exciting time. So we call that study Study 3. And for the genetics, we took a blood sample and sent it off to a special laboratory that's maintained by the National Institute on Aging. So people can actually go there and look at everything there. They can buy the cells. They don't know who that person is. They just know that they were a 100-year-old person and a male or female or black or white. We also have, we had many centenarians agree to give a brain donation. Of course, that would be upon death. And we have 51 brains stored at the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the University of Kentucky. And researchers can make a request to do studies on that tissue. And then all the usual suspects, cognition has always been a big part, nutrition, blood chemistry. And we had 244 centenarians in that study, and then 80 octogenarians, so 80-year-old people. And then we had young controls for the genetics on that. So just a few of the things that we found. I was very interested in diabetes, and I thought, well, gosh, you can't possibly live to 100 if you have diabetes. I don't know exactly when people got diabetes, but we found among the 100-year-olds, about 28% of the African Americans had diabetes compared to 9% of the whites. So what was really interesting to me is that some of the diseases that we see differentiate by race or ethnicity in middle age and younger, older age, carry right on into to 100. Similarly, overweight and obesity, a quarter of those in that category had diabetes, but only 7% if they had normal or underweight. But there was no difference in whether people lived in a nursing home or were community dwelling. So it was just interesting to me that risk factors for diabetes carried right on in into the hundreds. So to me, this means we need to keep taking care of ourselves regarding diabetes and other chronic diseases as early in life as possible. We also looked at dementia, and there's an extensive interview that can be done. It's called it has a questionnaire. It's called the Global Deterioration Scale. And of our 100-year-old people, we found that 68% of African Americans had dementia and 45% of the whites. And we don't know why that's true.
Yeah. On that slide, so it indicates we're better off being overweight. We're more likely to live to 100 if we're overweight or obese.
What that means is among those centenarians who were overweight or obese, about a quarter of them had diabetes. Oh. But if they were normal or underweight, only about 7%. Yeah. So it keeps, our weight keeps being a risk factor. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing we found, too, that's a little bit confusing is in our longitudinal study, we found that people that weighed a little bit more actually lived longer. So I'm going with the weight a little bit more. That's where I'm putting my bets. So. We don't really know why the blacks and whites differ so much in their prevalence of dementia. We think it's largely education is a huge protectant. So the more education that we have, the more that we're protected from dementia. We have what's called cognitive reserve. So it's never too late. Keep exercising the mind. So like Carolyn said, I have a new job this year, so brain is being really exercised. So, and then you see the education right here. So dementia has a 71% prevalence among those who did not graduate from high school, but quote-unquote only 42% of those who did graduate high school. So big difference.
Did you separate the blacks and the whites?
I don't have it with me, but yeah, there'd be an interaction, yeah. So it would probably, both factors are in play there. And not surprisingly, a very large number of the 100-year-old people that are in a nursing home have dementia compared to those who are out in the community. I'm going to just skip the next slide because I wanted to share with you something. So we had ultimately had 244 100-year-old people that enrolled in the study. And when we were trying to get the funding from the federal government, we said, well, we want to ask these 100-year-old people for a brain donation. Everyone was like, no, not going to happen. It won't happen. It won't happen. To donate their brain when they, upon their death. They said, won't happen. There's too much has happened in the South that the blacks won't trust you. You won't, it's just not going to happen. Well, we had a nurse, an excellent nurse, and she worked with other experts in the field of, how do you approach a person and their family to ask for a brain donation. And they were able to get they were able to approach about 211 people, and of those 211 people, 61 agreed. And that was in this line of work, a very high success rate. And then of that 61, we were able to, get to the family and the individual who had passed away, 51 of those 61. So a very high success rate. So this produced one of the largest collections of, it's probably the largest collection of brain tissue in the world from 100-year-old people, and by far the most from African Americans. So it continues to be a good resource for study. So what are we finding in the brain? One of the things that we're looking at, we're doing some studies with Tufts University, and there's another Johnson there. Her name's Elizabeth. We're not related as far as we can figure out. And she's has a long interest in nutrition's effect on the brain. And she's interested in a chemical called, it's a fat called DHA. Have you heard of that one, DHA? We've got Carolyn here to answer any questions about that. But it's believed to be a very healthy fat that may be good for all kinds of things, especially for brain health. So what this shows is that in our blood, this red right here, that's the proportion of a group of fats that's found in the blood. But in the brain, it's a much higher concentration. So we're always interested, if we see something in the blood at kind of an average concentration, but then see it in the brain as a high concentration, that means there's a mechanism to pull it out and get it in a tissue where it's really needed. So clearly DHA is a very important fat in the brain simply by its presence being there. And this comes from fish, vegetable oils, and nuts, but by far the best source is from fish. This is one of the reasons we tell people, oh, you should eat some fish in your diet. And the health benefits may include maintenance of brain health. There's a lot of research going on in this area. Obviously, it's very hard to directly study in a living person how much DHA is in their brain. And so the science of this is a little bit challenging. But let me show you what we found in centenarians in Georgia. And this is Dr. Mark Sperry from University of Kentucky. He did all the autopsy and pathology on the brain tissue. We were able to go and visit him. He's an extremely famous researcher in this area. He passed away a few years ago. And of these 51 brains collected, about half had dementia. And so what my colleague did was in the dementia brain, it's there's so much damage, you can't really tell what's going on from a nutritional point of view. So she just took the brains that there was no dementia. So they were normal or had some subjective memory impairment, or they had mild cognitive impairment. Have you heard of that? MCI. So she took those, and she found of all the fats that she looked at, this DHA was strongly associated with better scores on 11 of the 14 different tests of cognition that we did. So all the tests of paper and pencil tests, asking people to remember things and all of that. So way more highly correlated than any other fat tissue. So she's continuing to help look into that a little more. Another thing that this colleague from Tufts is doing is she's looking at lutein. Have you heard of lutein? Heard of that? What's it good for? It's good. Your eyes. Yeah, she's an international expert on lutein and vision and lutein and the brain. And lutein has a sister chemical very similar in structure called zeaxanthin. You don't hear that much about that one, probably because nobody can spell it, but you hear about lutein all the time. And it comes from especially green plants and the other plants that are listed up here. Spinach and kale, very high source. Dandelion greens. I've not tried those. Maybe I should. And then you see eggs down here at the bottom. And eggs have a lot of lutein, and also because that's an animal food and it has a little bit of fat in there, it's very easy for our body to absorb.
Why does the egg yolk have how many grams and nothing else?
Oh, at the top, let me see, this is where my vision is not working. The other ones are the milligrams in a cup. And then this is the egg yolk per 100 gram. Yeah. Yeah.
Why is it saying that the fish are frozen? Everything fresh would be
lutein. Oh, yeah, that's a great question. What about fresh and frozen? Lutein is very stable, whether it's in a fresh food or a frozen. So I always keep a bag. Yeah, I always keep a bag of frozen spinach in my freezer, which, of course, has now been there a long time. You can't just keep the bag of frozen spinach in your freezer. You have to actually get it out and eat it. So it's stable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and I have the spinach quiche down there if you're wondering what that is. And if there's any chemists in the room, I know there's at least a few, the structure of... I can't see what the structure. I can't read it because I'm. Did I tell you I broke my glasses the other day? So I just have on my reading glasses. So, yeah. If you're waving at me and I don't call on you, I can't see you. That's the problem. Okay. Okay. So what about this lutein and centenarians? Well, what Liz found is that the brain seems to preferentially accumulate lutein and some related chemicals from mostly from vegetables compared to other chemicals. So let me explain. So this is the amount of certain phytochemicals, we call them, and this one's lutein in the brain. And you can see the brain, it's lutein and zeaxanthin. And these are carotenoids. I think that's beta carotene, for example. So not so much beta carotene, even though most people eat a lot of that. Carrots, sweet potatoes, and a lot of vegetables. And this is the serum. See, they're lower. This lutein is lower relative to the serum. So the serum is where the orange, or the carotenoid, beta carotene, is hanging out. But the brain wants to enrich with lutein. Does that sort of make sense? Yeah. Serum is our blood, so yeah. So it seems that there must be some special transport of this lutein from the blood into the brain. Yeah, yeah, it's real interesting. And so she's trying to figure out, you know, what is the transport system. She right now can only tell it's in the brain, not really what it's doing. So she's trying to figure out exactly where does lutein go in the brain tissue. And what does it do there? So she will be working with animal models and things like that to try to figure that out. Another thing that she's looked at is trying to figure out how related is lutein to brain health. And so this column is very good brain health. This is subjective memory loss, and this is mild cognitive impairment. So from going from good to worse, and the lutein in the brain is highest in the well-functioning brain, but lowest in the poor-functioning brain. Beta-carotene, when you control for other factors, doesn't show the big difference. So something special about lutein. Other nutrients like vitamin A and vitamin E, we hear a lot about vitamin E. Maybe not so much anymore. Oh, it must be healthy. It must be good for you. It's an antioxidant. But brain doesn't preferentially accumulate that chemical form of vitamin E at all. So this is the kind of data that we're using to build a case that there may be something special about this lutein. And then we're always trying to figure out, well, we tell people eat this, eat that, but we always have to have a mechanism behind it. And some of the mechanisms that are being explored are maybe these are structural proteins. You've heard of anti-inflammatory. That's a big thing now. Maybe that's what's going on, antioxidant. Or maybe something in the membranes, the synapses, and then there's gap junction communication. But just a whole range of things we're trying to figure out. What could this chemical be doing in the brain? Okay. Well, that's kind of what I've got on brain for you. I'm going to tell you about one of my favorite nutrients, and that's vitamin B12. Have you heard much about vitamin B12? Did you hear about that? Yeah. In our 100-year-old people, there's a very high prevalence of B12 deficiency, and about just over 20% of our 80-year-olds had B12 deficiency, and a third of the 100-year-olds. And then there was another 17 people who were getting B12 injections, so you don't really know how to categorize them. Hopefully they were getting the B12 injections because they had a deficiency and need it to maintain, but sometimes people just, you could tell your doctor, I'm feeling a little tired, and they might say, oh, let's give you some B12. So we don't really know why they were taking that. And it wasn't related to a condition called macrocytosis. That's when the cells are too big, bigger than normal. But what we found, the people most likely to have B12 deficiency were whites. For some reason, blacks are protected. It seems to be their genetic handling of B12. There's a condition called atrophic gastritis. Has anyone heard of that? Have you heard of that? Sometimes when we get older or have a stomach infection, our atrophy means breakdown. So there's a breakdown of the gastric tissue, so breakdown of the stomach tissue. And your body can't absorb B12 as well anymore. So it's not surprising people who had that condition weren't absorbing B12 very well. And they also weren't taking a B12 supplement. And this prevalence of B12 inadequacy is so high, it makes you wonder, well, maybe we should have a food policy, a fortification policy. Do you read your breakfast cereal in the morning and see all those kind of scary-sounding words on there? Many of those are vitamins and minerals. And but we don't have a special policy that maybe we should be putting a little bit of B12, say, in our bread or cereal. It's in a lot of cereals, but it doesn't have to be there. Other nutrients, it's very strongly encouraged by the federal government that we put these nutrients in there.
Of the elderly are, as you said, type 2 diabetics,
uh-huh.
And they will manage their diabetes with a drug called metformin.
Uh-huh.
Metformin impairs drastically the uptake, the absorption of vitamin B12,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so the two are related in this respect. And
uh-huh.
I noted that the number of people you had that were diabetic and the number of people with B12 deficiency
mm-hmm.
were fairly close together.
Right. And I have not looked at that. So, yeah, I'll take a look at that. Because it could be medication interaction. Another medication that can interfere with B12 absorption are antacids, because you need acid to help you absorb B12 from your stomach and intestine. Okay, so that's another one to check on that. Okay. Well, we didn't look a lot at religion and spirituality issues in our studies, but there has been some work with other teams. And this is a group from the Midwest, and they did a qualitative study in religion and spirituality area. So in qualitative research, you do a lot of asking and probing and letting people tell their story. And then the researcher takes all that information and tries to draw out some themes. So a few of the themes that came forward were, the first was divine support, that God had brought me through it all. He's been with me every day and brought me through everything that I had to go through. And that's the big thing in my life. And that's certainly something that we saw in the 100-year-old people that we worked with. Tremendous joy in their life, but also tremendous loss. And it's really, people need a support system to get through all that. Also, with the many life events that our very old people experience, you also see a lot of resilience in our oldest people. And from a spiritual point of view, one person said, "A deep faith helps me to accept." And you sure have to accept a lot of things in this life. And a third theme that these researchers in the Midwest found was spirituality over the life course. And I know I see that in one of the members of my Sunday school group. She's 96 years old. She cannot see very well at all. But you name anyone from the Bible, any can't remember what verse, she has it just instantly. She's had a deep religious training and experience through her life. And one of these individuals in the study from the Midwest talked about, from the time I could talk, I was taught to love and trust God. And you're not taught that. It grows on you. It helps you live better and makes your life better. So from the spiritual sense, it just becomes, I believe, more and more important as a means for people to discover the joy of living a very long life, but also how to get through many hard times. Well, I wanted to make sure we had a little bit of time for questions, so I've just got one more slide. Oh, I guess I have two more. So when we look all across the world, all these studies of 100-year-old people, how do people get to 100? What is it about? And it helps to be in teams that are looking at it from different point of view. Genetics has got something going on, but we have not been able to conclusively figure out what's the genetics. So there is a gene for it. So ApoE. Have you heard of that one? ApoE. If you have the bad version of that, not so likely to get to 100. That's one of the few consistent findings genetically around the world. And a lot of people have been working on this. Health behaviors are certainly important. Keeping cholesterol under control, keeping blood pressure controlled, eating right, exercising. You saw those incredible people. It's not like you turn 100 and then you can swim 1,500 meters. That's a health behavior that you've been maintaining for a long time. So it's just astonishing, what we can do. So, wherever you are on your keeping yourself, being able to move as much as possible, just keep working on it. It pays just huge dividends. And the health behaviors in South Korea, where in one area men tend to live, there's more men in centenarians than expected. It was in a mountainous area. And we think that so much more exercise might have been helping them. You couldn't get anywhere in this mountain community without walking uphill at least one way. Okay, and then environment, social networks, education, income. That we see that that's very important. Education, income, important around the world. We have several investigators looking at personality, and the results aren't real clear what kind of personality type takes you to 100. In our early studies, being suspicious was overrepresented among centenarians. What do you think about that? How would being suspicious maybe help you live?
It could be healthy skepticism.
Yes, so a healthy skepticism. Yes. So that's something that's come up over the years, but they're still working on that. I suspect that the personality interacts a lot with your life events, and so it may just depend on what kind of life you've had too. Then our demographer that I just love so much, who could, it was with a bazillion facts that every time we'd get together. He's like, it's just chance, it's just chance. So maybe that does have a big role to play as well. Well, what's it like to be 100? You can't deny that many people have health problems. I didn't go into all the nutrition problems, but there's some nutrition problems that are being overlooked. There is huge variability among people. If you've met one centenarian, you've met one centenarian. They're just so different in the life that they've had and the experiences that they've had. But one thing for sure, they have all seen a lot of living. And one of the most remarkable people we got to know very well in Georgia was Annie Nixon Cooper. And she was from Atlanta, and she lived to the age of 107. And Obama called her out in his 2008 speech and called her an example of the heartbreak and the hope of the past century. And he noted she'd been born at a time when women and blacks couldn't vote and lived to cast her ballot for the country's first black president. That's quite a lifetime, 100 years. So who knows for all of us if we'll make it to 100? And think of all the things that we'll get to see. So it really is a miracle to live to 100 and beyond and experience so many remarkable things. There's continuity through your families and spiritual life, but so much change. And, of course, none of us knows if we'll reach 100, but it is certainly becoming more and more common. It's estimated, I've seen estimates of something like 1 out of 5 of the children born today might live to 100. Yeah, it's just some of those projections. It's all statistical, but still, it's about chance. But it is something we need to prepare for. In our faith communities, churches always, as you know, pick up a lot of what needs to be done to help people continue to experience the joy of living a long life, and of course in our secular communities as well. Well, we have just a few minutes. If you had any more, any other questions, I'd be real happy to answer those or discuss them through with you. Yes.
I wouldn't care if I eat sausage or, it's kind of like, yep. I'm going to do it all for whatever time I want. Yep. So I'm thinking, would that skew your research in some way?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it was, if you get to 96, 97, 8, 99, 100, maybe I'll just start eating whatever I feel like now. Yeah, it might. And that's something when we, we were just observing everyone. Unless we saw a problem that was actionable that we needed to report, we were just observing. But yeah, I never felt really in a place that I could really make a recommendation to a 100-year-old person. And like, well, they got this far, so.
It reminded of the story of this man who went to see his doctor, and he asked his doctor, "What can I do to live a long life?" And the doctor had this long, long list of do's and don'ts. And the patient listened very carefully and intently. And finally, the list was completed, and so he said, and if I follow all these rules, will I live a long life? And the physician said, no, but it'll seem like it.
And you know, we always need to respect people's choice and what they want to do, no matter what their age. And that's getting to be more and more of a thing when we're thinking about how to best serve and support older people. So you can make up your mind at any age what you want to do.
Just real quick, what about smoking?
Oh, I didn't mention smoking. Well, one of the earliest reported studies of 100-year-old people was from Hungary. They smoke like chimneys over there. Yeah. It was unbelievable. So that's one of the few places where we saw such a high prevalence of smoking. But in most countries, very little smoking. But then people always remind us, you know, if you go back to 1900, there wasn't a lot of smoking. So sometimes we get a little mixed up on what we call the cohort effect and what's a real predictor of longevity. Does this sort of make sense? So we're always a little cautious. It certainly makes sense that smoking is not compatible with living a long life. But I wanted to give you a little backstory that, you know, that's why having a control group is so important. You've got to compare it to something. I think there was some questions over here. Yes?
What does the data suggest in terms of why there are so many more women than men who are likely to live to 100?
Yeah, we have not. Yeah.
We're the weaker sex.
That nobody's been able to figure that out. They always just default to estrogen. So, you know, that's just a difference in female hormones. But we really haven't figured that out, why men and women have very different patterns of disease and longevity. One of the things is that men, especially in the United States and in Western countries, are at higher risk for heart disease. And so it may be through that pathway we just lose men earlier. Women tend to be more susceptible to chronic conditions, so there's more arthritis and things like that, which, you know, is very unpleasant, but, you know, isn't life-threatening. Yeah, so we have not figured that out.
Any studies on the use of drugs and alcohol?
Alcohol is information is really hard to get. Yeah, so in Georgia, I've screened thousands of people. So tell me how many alcoholic drinks do you have a week? None. You know, I go for years. No one will tell me. But we haven't really seen. There's very limited data, and we haven't really seen much of anything. I mean, it seems to be low, but we can't figure out if that's just low reporting on that. Yeah. Pennsylvanians might tell me if they're having a drink a day, but Georgians are not going to. Yes.
One suggestion and one question. The suggestion would be, I am a retired RN, and I belong to a program that studies nurses.
Oh.
And it's probably been 40 years that I, uh-huh. every 2 years, I fill out uh-huh. Forms. And it's out of Boston.
Uh-huh.
So maybe you could get some information.
That's great. That's a great suggestion. And so the suggestion is, in some of the studies that have been following people for a very long time, it's called the Nurses Health Study, I think. Does that sound right? My mother-in-law is in that study, so she used to send me the questionnaire all the time. But yes, but what's happening is some of these studies have been going on so long now that they now have groups of people that are 100 years and older. That's a great suggestion.
I didn't quite get there yet.
Yeah.
Also, can you get any kind of information from people or their family? Whenever on your driver's license you indicate that you are an organ donor, could you get brains that way?
Oh, I don't know. Could we get a brain through the organ donor system on the card, on the driver's license? I don't know. I'd have to check into that. Yeah.
Yeah, nobody would tell you not to do
it. I would just encourage you all to think seriously about organ donation, though. We're able to learn. I can't tell you exactly what we're learning from the brain pathology, from the hundreds of people, because it's so sophisticated, I can only give you a little window. But we will learn so much from that tissue to help us better understand, you know, what's the pathology of Alzheimer's, what might be some of the risk factors and things like that. So I would encourage you to be a donor if you can. Was there some questions here?
I remember my grandmother, both of them, they had a wonderful sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
They just were able to enjoy life and share joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think having a sense of humor is really wonderful.
Yeah, sense of humor. And we certainly saw that throughout our studies as well. And I think that goes into resilience and coping, of how to just take what life throws at you and make the best of it. Well, thank you so much for having me here today.